Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 102.
Welcome, everyone. Today we're taking a magnifying glass to a very specific, just incredibly pivotal chapter 102 of the classic novel Dream of the Red Chamber. Okay, let's get into the text. We start our journey with a literal passing of the torch, though reading the details, it feels much more like handing off a ticking time bomb.
That's a very accurate way to put it.
So the text opens with Lady Wang, the matriarch essentially running the inner household, and she summons Bochai. Now, Bochai is of the younger generation. She's married into the family, and suddenly she's being asked to take over the management of this massive, sprawling estate.
And the justification Lady Wang provides for stepping down is really telling. It's entirely physical, which perfectly mirrors the state of the institution itself.
Right. She claims to suffer from, 10 illnesses and 9 pains.
Yes. And on top of that, the second sister-in-law, she's also incapacitated.
She's described as being well for 3 days and sick for 2. Right?
Exactly. The immune system of the household's leadership has just completely failed.
So Lady Wang brings Bochai in and delivers what is essentially a corporate onboarding speech. She tells Bochai that she has a clear mind, that she can no longer just swallow her pride and be afraid to offend people.
Which is quite the burden to place on someone young.
Right. The entire household is her burden now. But the actual advice Lady Wang gives, the critical warning she imparts, while handing over this financially bleeding enterprise, it's entirely focused on a maid.
It's amazing. It reveals this profound disconnect between the executive leadership and the actual existential threats facing the organization.
Okay, let's unpack this because this fascinated me.
Well, in modern organizational psychology, there's this heavily studied phenomenon known as the glass cliff.
Like the glass ceiling.
Exactly. We're all familiar with the glass ceiling. But the glass cliff occurs when a company is already in a severe, often terminal crisis.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it's precisely at the moment of impending doom that the organization finally promotes a woman or a younger, marginalized figure to the role of CEO.
With the underlying mechanism being that when the inevitable failure finally happens, the new leader absorbs all the systemic blame.
You nailed it. Bochai is being placed squarely on the glass cliff. The family has completely exhausted its supply of competent, healthy, traditional managers. Lady Wang is just tapping out.
So Bochai is the fall guy, or fall girl, rather.
Basically, yes. And observe what Lady Wang chooses to focus on during this transition. I mean, the estate's agricultural yields are failing, daily expenditures drastically exceed income, the infrastructure is crumbling.
Lady Wang does not discuss the balance sheet.
Not at all.
It's like a CEO being brought in to manage a company that's quietly bankrupt, and the outgoing boss pulls her aside to warn her about office gossip.
That's a perfect analogy.
She warns Bochai about a new maid that was just brought in by another servant, Pinger, to replace a recently fired maid. Lady Wang explicitly states she doesn't think this new girl looks settled or trustworthy.
And then she excavates this deep historical trauma within the family, reminding Bochai of the girls she had to fire previously because they were, quote, fox-like.
Yeah, fox-like. What does she even mean by that in this context?
To understand the weight of that warning, you really have to understand the specific trauma in this household. Lady Wang is referring to past purges she orchestrated, mostly involving this tragic, beautiful, and fiercely independent maid named King Wen.
Oh, right, King Wen.
Yeah, in Lady Wang's worldview, a maid who is too alluring, too sharp-tongued, or just too independent represents a catastrophic threat to the moral fabric of the household.
And thereby the stability of it.
Exactly. She views aesthetic compliance and pure subservience as the ultimate metrics of security.
So she's basically fighting the last war. The stock is crashing, regulators are circling the building, and she's worried someone in accounting is taking unauthorized coffee breaks.
It's a total collapse of perspective. The macro environment is simply too terrifying for Lady Wang to comprehend, so she hyperfixates on the micro environment.
She insists that out of the entire staff of hundreds, only one maid, Siren, can be fully trusted.
Which is wild. Creating a culture of intense suspicion like that establishes an incredibly fragile, paranoid foundation for Bochai. Bochai is basically inheriting a management structure defined entirely by what it fears rather than what it actually intends to build.
Wow. Okay, so as Bochai takes on this suffocating administrative burden, the text pivots to another key figure making an exit. Tan Chun.
Yes, Tan Chun.
Yeah.
She's widely established as one of the most capable, clear-headed, and pragmatic young women in the family.
And she's leaving to be married. She's traveling far away, journeying by water and land, effectively just removing herself from the narrative of the household.
It's a huge loss for the family's operational capacity.
And we get this very intense farewell scene between Tanshin and Baoyu. Now, Baoyu is the emotional center of the family. He's deeply sensitive, profoundly attached to the women and girls in his life.
And he is absolutely devastated by her departure. He's just weeping, unable to bear the physical separation.
Right. But Tanshin's response to his grief is what's really fascinating here. She doesn't break down and cry with him. She doesn't offer, like, standard emotional comfort.
No, she doesn't.
The text specifically notes that she counsels him using the principles of human relations. I think it's sometimes translated as the great principles of social bonds.
Yes, the Gengcheng Duty.
She essentially delivers a philosophical lecture on societal duty. And she does this so effectively that Baoyu transitions from weeping to sitting with his head down in silence to finally achieving a state of enlightened understanding.
It's quite a transformation.
And once he reaches that state, Tanshin feels relieved, boards her sedan chair, and leaves. So my question for you is, why choose philosophical principles over emotional empathy in a moment of profound personal loss?
Well, from a modern perspective, you know, we expect a tearful, highly emotive goodbye. Tanshin's stoicism can appear almost cold to a modern reader.
Yeah, it definitely reads a bit clinical at first glance.
But in the sociocultural architecture of Qing Dynasty society, these principles of human relations, the Confucian bonds dictating that daughters must eventually marry out, that families must disperse to fulfill societal roles, these aren't merely abstract theories.
Right.
They're the fundamental gravity that holds civilization together. Duty supersedes personal attachment.
So she is using that social gravity to anchor a brother who is basically floating away in his own despair.
Precisely. Baoyu is drowning in his emotions. If Tanshin validates the tragedy of their separation by breaking down with him, she just pulls them both under.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
By invoking these grand, unyielding societal principles, she throws him a life raft built of cold logic. She reframes his individual pain.
She communicates that this separation isn't some unique targeted cruelty inflicted upon them by the universe.
Exactly. It's just the fundamental design of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And by accepting the design, the pain loses its chaotic edge.
Plus, she probably needs to protect herself, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Tanshin needs to strategically sever her own emotional ties to survive this arduous journey and her new life. She's equipping Baoyu with the only armor available to him in a world that is rapidly emptying out.
And that concept of a rapidly emptying world brings us to the next massive shift in the text. Because as these competent, vibrant figures either step away or just get crushed under new burdens, the physical spaces they leave behind begin to reflect the internal void of the family.
The architecture literally begins to rot.
The physical environment in literature, and honestly often in life, operates as a mirror for the psychological state of its inhabitants.
Yeah, psychogeography at its finest.
Nowhere is this mirroring more aggressive than in the Grand View Garden. Now, for context for you listening, this garden was the crown jewel of the estate. It was designed as this vibrant, poetic utopia.
It was the exclusive domain of the youth, a place of poetry clubs, crab banquets, endless aesthetic refinement.
But now, the text provides a chilling roll call of absence. Concubine Jia, the imperial consort for whom this sprawling garden was originally constructed, dead.
Dayu, the undisputed soul of the garden's poetry, dead.
Sheng Yun has moved away. Bao Qian has returned to her home. The remaining sisters and Baoyu himself have all moved out of the garden enclosures because the population has dwindled so severely and the winter weather has turned freezing.
So what remains is this massive, sprawling landscape, populated only by a few solitary night watchmen.
The space has completely transitioned from an incubator of culture to a vacuum.
And in psychogeography, the study of how physical environments directly influence the emotions and behaviors of individuals, a vacuum of this scale generates profound anxiety.
Because nature abhors a vacuum.
Exactly. It will pull things in to fill the void.
And what gets pulled in triggers the first major incident. So Yuxi, the wife of Jizhen from the neighboring Ning mansion, she's visiting the wrong mansion to help send Tanshin off.
Right.
Because the hour has grown late and she wants to, you know, spare the servants the labor of hitching up a formal carriage, she makes a very pragmatic decision. She decides to simply walk home through a private side gate that connects the two massive mansions.
Cutting directly through the heart of the Grand View Garden at night.
Which seems like a terrible idea.
Taking a shortcut through a space heavily laden with unresolved grief is a very fateful decision.
Fateful is exactly the word. As she walks through the garden in the dark, the text delivers this visceral description of her experience. She is struck by a profound sense of loss.
The pavilions, the terraces, the architectural bones of the space are still standing, but they're utterly desolate.
Yeah, the beautifully manicured aesthetic borders along the parapets, they've been completely overgrown. They're reverting into wild, unkempt vegetable plots.
The cognitive dissonance between her memory of the garden at its peak and the stark reality of its current decay, it just hits her like a physical blow.
She returns to her mansion, and almost immediately she falls severely ill. Her temperature spikes, she's bedridden, and by nightfall, she's in a state of total delirium, just speaking endless, rambling nonsense.
Yorkshire's confronting the mortality of her entire family lineage through the landscape. She isn't just looking at overgrown weeds, she's witnessing the visual representation of the family's complete loss of control.
The wilderness is actively reclaiming their civilization.
Exactly. And the psychological weight of that realization is simply too heavy for her conscious mind to process, so it manifests somatically. The psychological trauma actually attacks her biological system.
The family's immediate reaction is to call a doctor. Now, this sequence is vital because it establishes the baseline of reality before the hysteria totally takes over.
Yes, the medical intervention is a key moment.
The doctor arrives, examines her, and delivers a highly specific diagnosis grounded entirely in traditional Chinese medicine. He determines that the illness began as a severe cold.
Which perfectly aligns with reality. I mean, you have a wealthy woman accustomed to indoor heating, walking outside through a freezing, neglected garden at night.
Right. But he goes further. He states that the cold pathogen has tangled its way into her meridians, specifically penetrating the stomach meridian of Foot Yangming.
The Foot Yangming meridian, yes.
The doctor explicitly notes that this blockage in the Yangming meridian is the direct cause of her delirium and hallucinations. He prescribes a specific medicinal decoction to clear the severe internal heat and filth, assuring the family that once the heat is cleared, her mental state will return to normal.
The doctor's diagnosis is a highly rational, systematized medical explanation within the established framework of traditional Chinese medicine.
So it's not mumbo jumbo.
Not at all. In TCM theory, the Yangming meridian is heavily associated with the stomach and the large intestine. When a pathogenic factor like extreme cold turns into internal heat and enters the Yangming stage, it generates a massive inflammatory response.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And the hallmark symptoms of Yangming stage illness are severe fever, profuse sweating, and crucially, intense mental restlessness and delirium. It's referred to in medical texts as Zanyu.
So the doctor is providing a totally mechanical explanation. The physical exposure to the cold, compounded by deep emotional distress, caused her body to generate excessive internal heat.
Exactly. That heat is affecting her brain, causing the hallucinations. He is essentially prescribing a culturally appropriate anti-inflammatory.
Okay, so wait. Let's look at the family's reaction to this because it completely defies all logic. The doctor gives a perfectly sound, logical medical explanation. A severe fever causing delirium is universally understood.
It's biology.
Right. But the family isn't satisfied. Yushi takes two doses of the prescribed medicine. She doesn't experience an instant miraculous recovery, in fact, as fevers often do right before they break. She becomes slightly more frantic.
Which is very common.
Yeah. But immediately, her son, Jia Rong, and her husband, Jia Zhen, they just discard the medical route entirely. They declare the doctor useless and pivot instantly to the supernatural. Why jump straight to demons when you have a perfectly coherent viral or bacterial explanation?
Because that pivot exposes the core of human nature during a systemic crisis.
So.
When individuals or organizations are trapped in profound, slow-moving disasters, a simple biological explanation feels deeply unsatisfying. It feels, well, disproportionate.
Disproportionate. I like that.
Think about it. This family is watching their multi-generational wealth evaporate, their political influence is waning, their children are dispersing. If Yushi is suffering from a common pathogen exacerbated by the cold, then the universe is just operating on random biological indifference.
Right. It means they're just unlucky or careless.
But if she is the victim of a targeted demonic attack,
then there's a narrative. There's an antagonist they can actually identify.
Exactly. A demon provides their ambient suffering with a concrete face. It gives them a tangible enemy. And most importantly, a supernatural explanation completely externalizes the blame.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. If she fell ill because the garden is freezing and overgrown, that implies the leadership has failed to maintain their own property. It points to internal rot.
Precisely. If she is sick because a monster attacked her, The family is absolved of structural responsibility. They are merely innocent victims of malicious cosmic forces.
So people crave dramatic supernatural explanations for their suffering because those explanations absolve them of the hard work of systemic reform.
Yes. And that desperate hunger for a narrative opens the door wide open for opportunists.
Enter the fortune teller. Here's where it gets really interesting. The medicine isn't working on the family's desired timeline, so Jia Rong approaches his father with a theory. He reminds Jia Zhen that Yuxi walked through the empty garden, suggesting she might have encountered something unclean.
He proposes bringing in a man named Mao Banxian, who is described as a southern fortune teller and an expert in divination.
Mao Banxian represents the external validation of their internal panic.
Absolutely. The scene where Mao Banxian arrives is just a masterclass in psychological manipulation.
He sits in the study, drinks his tea, and then initiates this elaborate performance. He begins with a coin divination. He shakes the coins in a bamboo tube, loudly invoking the grandest, most ancient authorities possible.
Right. He calls upon Tai Chi, the dual energies of yin and yang, the ancient mythical sage Fuxi, King Wen, Confucius.
He's name-dropping the heavy hitters.
Exactly. He throws the coins and declares he has cast the Ouija hexagram. From there, he just floods the room with heavy astrological jargon. He warns of danger from fire and siblings.
He points out that the parents line within the hexagram has transformed into a ghost line. He says this indicates severe illness for the mother and potential looming danger for the father, Jia Zhen.
He is not merely reading coins. He's reading his audience. He's laying down a psychological framework perfectly designed to trap them.
And the manipulation deepens. Jia Rong, who is totally hooked by the initial reading, asks for more specific details. Mao Banxian happily obliges by switching to an even more complex esoteric method known as De Liu Ren divination.
A very sophisticated astrological system.
Right. He draws out a complex chart, calculates the exact time, and announces his findings. He says the reading reveals a white tiger spirit situated on the easy branch of the calendar, generating a highly dangerous scenario he calls soul dissolving.
Soul dissolving? It sounds terrifying.
It really does. He claims this indicates that a hidden, crouching white tiger in an old house is causing the illness. But just as despair sets in, he calculates a rescue star.
Of course he does.
Yeah, he promises the situation will transition from soul dissolving to soul returning, predicting a full recovery precisely on the U day of the calendar.
We really need to dissect the architecture of Mao Banxian's technique here. The line between a genuine believer in divination and a cynical fraud is deliberately blurred, but the psychological utility is undeniable.
So break down the Ouija hexagram for me. Why that one?
Consider the specific hexagram he claims to cast. In the I Ching, the Book of Changes, Ouija is the 64th and final hexagram. It translates literally to not yet completed or before completion.
Okay.
It's composed of the trigram for fire above the trigram for water, because fire naturally moves upward and water naturally moves downward. The two elements are moving away from each other. They cannot interact to complete a process.
Oh, wow. So they're pulling apart.
Yes. It symbolizes a state of transition, profound dislocation, and looming danger where things are fundamentally out of place.
So he isn't just diagnosing a fever. He is diagnosing the existential dread of the entire Jia family.
Exactly. He's providing a cosmic reflection of their earthly reality. The Jia family is in a dangerous, incomplete transition, slowly falling apart.
And by deploying incredibly dense, impenetrable jargon, white tiger, soul dissolving, yang, and yin elements, he just overwhelms their critical thinking faculties.
By wrapping his diagnosis in mystical mathematics, he forces the family to rely on him as the sole interpreter of reality. He gives them a highly structured map of the invisible world that perfectly validates their unstructured, invisible fears.
The immediate consequence of this reading is just a staggering display of confirmation bias. Jia Rong hears the phrases hidden tiger and old house, and his brain instantly maps those vague astrological concepts onto the most ridiculous low-level servant gossip circulating the estate.
Right, he connects totally unrelated dots.
He runs back to his father, Jia Zhen, and stitches together this unified conspiracy theory. He reminds his father that the servants have been gossiping about seeing a hairy, lantern-eyed monster on the garden rockery.
And he brings up older rumors, too, that the deceased maid King Wen has become a flower goddess, and that mysterious heavenly music was heard when Dai Yu died.
Jia Rong takes an abstract astrological shirt and treats it as concrete, empirical proof that the garden is infested with monsters.
The human brain is a relentless pattern recognition machine. When an organization is gripped by fear, its members will connect data points that have absolutely no causal relationship.
Yeah, they're just grasping at straws.
Jia Rong takes isolated, fundamentally unrelated tragedies, the deaths of young women from chronic illness, a servant inventing a tall tale to avoid getting in trouble for sleeping on a night shift, and his mother's feverish delirium, and he strings them all together using the fortune teller's jargon to construct a unified theory of supernatural assault.
To put this in modern terms, Mao Banksian functions exactly like a predatory social media algorithm.
Oh, that's a great way to look at it.
Right. He sits in the room, ingests their data, assesses their baseline anxiety, and feeds them the exact content they are already psychologically primed to click on. They wanted a ghost story to absolve themselves of responsibility, so he gave them the math to prove it was objectively real.
That analogy holds up perfectly. He is optimizing their fear for his own relevance. But the resolution of this divination episode is what actually seals the family's fate.
Because the family is terrified by the white tiger diagnosis. So what is their actionable response? Do they hire better doctors? Do they increase the medical dosage?
Wrong.
No. Jia Zhen orders the servants to take stacks of paper money into the freezing garden and burn it as a sacrificial offering to appease the spirits.
And here is the twist that ruins everything. It appears to work.
Yeah. The text notes that on that very night, Yuxi breaks into a massive heavy sweat. Her fever finally breaks, and she gradually begins to recover, perfectly aligning with the Zhu Day that Mao Banksian predicted. So did the paper money cure the infection?
This is a textbook intersection of the placebo effect and the natural biological course of an illness.
Right, because the TCM doctor already gave her medicine.
Exactly. The doctor had already administered a strong anti-inflammatory decoction designed to clear internal heat. Biologically, fevers break through, diaphoresis, sweating.
So the paper money did nothing biologically.
The ritual of burning paper money did not cure a bacterial or viral infection. What it did was act as a massive psychological release valve for the entire household. It drastically reduced the ambient stress in the environment.
And when the family stopped panicking, stopped hovering, and felt a sense of ritualistic control, Yuxi's natural fever-breaking process was allowed to run its course.
Because the biological clock happened to align with the Yu Day, Mao Banksian is elevated from a street diviner to a literal prophet in their eyes.
Which is the most destructive possible outcome. Because once the leadership of the family validates this supernatural framework, once they genuinely believe that burning paper money cured a literal fever, the floodgates of unreality just burst open.
A localized, totally explainable illness transforms overnight into a full-blown contagion of panic.
We enter the phase of mass hysteria.
The virus of fear is infinitely more contagious and moves much faster than whatever physical pathogen caused Yuxi's fever.
The rumors detonate across the estate. The text states one person passes it to 10, 10 pass it to 100. Everyone in both mansions is talking about the monsters inhabiting the Grandview Garden.
And there's an immediate tangible consequence of this gossip.
Yeah.
Total infrastructural collapse.
Right. The watchmen, the laborers employed to maintain the immense property, they simply stop working. They refuse to prune the flowers, water the ancient trees, or tend to the remaining vegetable plots.
At night, the garden becomes a no-go zone.
Eventually, the paranoia reaches such a fever pitch that even in broad daylight, the servants refuse to walk alone. They move only in large groups, actively carrying weapons.
We're observing the total breakdown of the social contract and order within the micro-society of the estate.
And then the leadership falls to the contagion. Jia Zhen, the head of the Ning Mansion, falls ill. Given the environment, what is his protocol? He outright refuses to see a physician.
Instead, he retreats to the garden to burn more paper money and make wishes. He sets up elaborate altars in his courtyards to pray to the stars.
Shortly after, his son Jia Rong also falls sick. It triggers a domino effect of psychosomatic illness. For months, both massive mansions are paralyzed.
The text uses a brilliant, evocative idiom to describe the atmosphere. Every sound of the wind and every cry of the cranes, every blade of grass and every tree is seen as a demon.
We need to unpack the mechanics of this secondary wave of illness. Why are Jia Zhen and Jia Rong suddenly getting sick?
Well, it is almost certainly the result of severe chronic stress. sleep deprivation from staying up guarding against monsters, and the actual biological contagion of living in an enclosed environment with hundreds of panicked people whose immune systems are compromised by anxiety.
But in an environment governed by mass hysteria, biological reality is erased. Every cough, every shadow in the hallway, every stress-induced migraine is immediately attributed to the monster.
Right. And consider the labor dynamics at play here. How much of this hysteria is actually just a highly effective, unspoken excuse for the staff to stop working?
Oh, it absolutely is.
The text explicitly notes that the Watchmen are actively making up elaborate stories about flower demons and tree monsters, specifically so they can demand to abandon their posts, move out of the freezing garden, and seal the gates.
That is a crucial socioeconomic observation. Hysteria frequently provides a convenient, unassailable cover for labor disputes or the avoidance of miserable duties.
Right, because who wants to patrol a freezing garden at 2 a.m.?
Exactly. The garden in winter is freezing, neglected, and depressing. If a watchman complains that he's too cold to work, he risks being beaten for insubordination or fired.
However, if that same watchman claims a 10-foot demon with glowing eyes chased him through the rockery, he becomes a victim of the crisis. He gets hazard pay, he is allowed to sleep in the warm main house, and his dereliction of duty is sanctioned by the leadership's own paranoia. Fear becomes a highly tradable currency.
And the economic fallout from this currency of fear is catastrophic. This is where the rubber meets the road. The monsters are a collective delusion, but the financial drain is mathematically real.
Because the garden is entirely abandoned. All the agricultural revenue it generated, the fruits, the vegetables, the cash crops used to offset the massive daily costs of the estate, is completely wiped off the ledger.
Furthermore, because everyone is terrified of the dark, the household leadership is forced to drastically increase the monthly allowances just to hire extra security personnel, buy weapons, and purchase massive amounts of candles, oil, and food for the people sitting up all night keeping watch.
The wrong mansion, which the text has already established is struggling to balance its books, begins hemorrhaging silver at an unprecedented rate.
This is the real-world cost of fake news. A society or a corporation cannot function if it cannot agree on baseline reality.
They are literally bankrupting themselves to build a defense system against an enemy that does not exist. They are burning their own dwindling resources to heat an empty room while ignoring the actual structural deficit.
As the financial crisis deepens, the hysteria escalates into fatal territory. We're given the brief, heartbreaking story of Woogie's wife. Woogie is a lower-level servant. His wife contracts a mild, mundane cold.
Right.
While Woogie is out late, his wife attempts to self-medicate and accidentally takes the wrong medicinal herbs. When Woogie returns home, he finds his wife dead on her bed.
It's a completely mundane, tragic medical accident caused by mixing the wrong roots.
But because the entire estate is marinating in a toxic atmosphere of supernatural terror, the neighbors do not look at the situation rationally. They don't conclude she overdosed on the wrong prescription.
No. They immediately declare that a monster climbed over the courtyard wall and sucked her life force out.
It represents the ultimate totalizing power of the narrative. A totally explainable medical error is instantly co-opted and absorbed into the monster mythos.
The hysteria functions like a black hole. It consumes every random event, every human error, every misfortune, and bends it to fit the parameters of the conspiracy.
The tragic irony is just blinding. The most dangerous entity inside the GA estate isn't a demon lurking in the shadows. It's simply terrible medical literacy.
The woman died because she didn't know how to properly read or dose her prescription, not because a goblin ate her soul.
The truth is boring, sad, and speaks to systemic educational neglect. The monster story is thrilling, and more importantly, it continuously validates their collective panic.
And the reaction from the highest levels of authority only accelerates the chaos. The grandmother, the ultimate matriarch, panics upon hearing the rumors.
She deploys a small army of guards to physically surround Bayou's room because he is paralyzed by terror. The younger maids are running through the halls, screaming that they are seeing red-faced monsters and beautiful demon women peering through the windows. The estate descends into absolute anarchy.
But in the midst of this screaming, chaotic unreality, we do get a brief, striking glimmer of actual leadership.
Yes. Bao Chai, the young woman who was handed the keys to this sinking ship back in Section 1, she steps up.
She does not order the burning of paper money. She does not pray to the stars.
The text emphasizes her pragmatism. When she overhears the maids spreading these ridiculous, escalating rumors, she threatens to beat them. She establishes a hard physical boundary. And quite tellingly, the rumors immediately quiet down in her specific vicinity.
The contrast between Bao Yu's paralyzing, indulgent fear and Bao Chai's grounded disciplinary approach is really striking. Bao Yu allows the emotion to dictate reality. Bao Chai manages the reality to control the emotion.
She understands intrinsically that the cure for mass hysteria isn't more magic or more validation. It is strict, unyielding boundaries.
Right. She recognizes that the maids are feeding off each other's escalating energy. By threatening a very real, immediate physical consequence, a beating, she snaps their nervous systems out of the supernatural delusion.
The threat of a real-world consequence easily overrides the fear of an imaginary monster. But Bao Chai is just one individual operating in a single courtyard. She does not have the institutional power to hold back the tide of an entire estate determined to lose its mind.
The panic has rooted itself too deeply in the leadership.
The family decides that a supernatural problem requires a massive supernatural solution. And this logic brings us to one of the most absurd, highly theatrical, and honestly darkly comical set pieces in the entire novel.
The staging of the grand exorcism.
Yes. Jia Shi, the elder uncle of the family who previously prided himself on being a skeptic who didn't believe in ghosts, decides he must investigate the garden himself.
He picks a bright, sunny day, gathers a massive entourage of heavily armed servants, and marches into the Grand View Garden.
Even in broad daylight, everyone is terrified. The text notes the yin energy is oppressive, which is essentially an 18th century way of saying the vibes are absolutely terrible.
The vibes were definitely off.
Suddenly, as they are walking, there is a loud ruckus sound. A colorful wild pheasant bursts out of the brush. A young servant in the entourage gets so violently startled that his legs just give out.
He collapses to the ground and begins screaming that he just saw a monster with a yellow face, a bright red beard, wearing green and blue clothes, scrambling into a cave.
We must pause on the mechanics of this servant's hallucination because the author is demonstrating brilliant psychological insight here.
Fear physically and chemically alters perception.
Exactly.
The servant's brain is flooded with cortisol and adrenaline. He has walked into the garden absolutely certain he will encounter a monster. Therefore, when a brightly colored pheasant, a large bird with brilliant red, green, and blue plumage, bursts from the bushes, his visual cortex misinterprets the raw data.
In a split second of sheer panic, the bird's feathers are reconstructed by his terrified mind into a detailed humanoid demon wearing colorful clothes and sporting a red beard.
And Jia Shi, the supposed skeptic, completely loses his nerve. He is terrified by the scream, asks the other armed servants if they saw the monster, and the servants, desperate to save face and agree with their master, claim they saw it too.
Of course they do. Jia Shi flees the garden in a panic and immediately orders the mobilization of a grand exorcism. He doesn't hire one priest. He hires 49 Taoist priests.
The scale of 49 priests is highly intentional. The institutional response must be massive and overwhelming to successfully counter the massive, overwhelming anxiety of the estate.
The exorcism is an absolute circus of sensory overload. They construct gigantic, towering altars in the main hall of the garden. They bring in statues of the three pure ones, the 28 mansions of the zodiac, and the 36 heavenly generals.
There are clouds of incense, mountains of flowers, blazing candles, clanging bells, booming drums, and massive five-colored flags flapping in the wind.
The priests themselves are wearing elaborate seven-star crowns and nine-palace, eight-trichogram robes. They wield heavy swords and crack peachwood whips.
They spend an entire day merely chanting to cleanse the altar space, and then they issue a literal written summons, essentially a bureaucratic arrest warrant, ordering the local gods to arrive and assist them in apprehending the demons.
To understand why this works, we have to deconstruct the exorcism not as magic, but as highly orchestrated performance art and systemic therapy.
The elaborate props, the deafening chanting, the intricate costumes, they are all specifically engineered to overwhelm the senses.
Right. When a community's collective mind is trapped in a closed loop of invisible, creeping anxiety, you must introduce a sensory overload of visible, structured power to break the cycle.
Notice the specific deities invoked. The 28 mansions and the 36 heavenly generals. These are not chaotic nature spirits. This is the organized, militarized bureaucracy of the heavens.
Oh, that's such a good point. The family is experiencing a catastrophic failure of their earthly, secular bureaucracy, so they project a perfect, fully functioning cosmic bureaucracy onto the problem to restore order.
The rituals are a physical, deafening manifestation of order being violently imposed upon chaos.
It is the ultimate spectacle. Every member of the family crowds around the perimeter to watch. The priests wave their heavy flags. They splash consecrated water on every single pavilion, rock, and ancient tree in the massive garden. They crack their wooden whips at the empty air.
And then comes the climax of the performance.
The priests open up small, empty bottles, perform elaborate pantomimes of wrestling invisible demons into the glass, slam the stoppers in, seal the bottles with paper talismans covered in red ink, and loudly announce they are taking the captured demons away to be permanently imprisoned under a distant pagoda.
And the critical analytical question is, what exactly are they capturing in those sealed bottles?
Jirong is standing in the back of the crowd, secretly mocking the entire affair. He whispers to his relatives, "I thought we were finally going to see what these monsters actually look like. They just bottled up thin air. Did they even catch anything at all?"
But Jiazin, his father, overhears the mockery and scolds him. And in doing so,
he tells his son, "Demons are just gathered energy. When they scatter, they become invisible air again. With all these powerful gods present, do you think the energy dares to take shape? The priests have gathered up this demonic energy so it can no longer cause trouble. That is the true nature of their magic."
That statement is staggering in its accuracy. Jiazin, perhaps unwittingly, is perfectly diagnosing the root cause of the estate's collapse.
The energy haunting the garden isn't supernatural. It is the dense collective anxiety, the unspoken guilt, the terror of the estate's inevitable economic and structural decline.
Jiazin realizes, on a fundamental level, that the exorcism is essentially a massive, exorbitantly expensive group therapy session, official permission structure to stop being afraid.
Oh, like giving them an out.
Yes. The highest authority figures available, the imported priests, have publicly, loudly, and officially declared the physical space safe. The ambient anxiety has been physically symbolized, bottled, and removed from the premises.
The watchmen and servants can now return to their posts without losing face or admitting they were terrified of the dark because the demon has been officially evicted by the state.
It's brilliant, really.
It is the exact same mechanism as calling IT support because your computer is running slowly. The IT technician knows you simply have 45 browser tabs open and haven't restarted your machine in a month.
Right.
But instead of lecturing you, they open the command prompt, type in some green hacker-looking diagnostic code, hit enter, and assure you they have flushed the mainframe.
They put on a highly technical show to make the user feel safe and confident, and the user goes back to work.
The text explicitly notes that after the exorcism, the servants stopped being scared, everyone who was suffering from psychosomatic illnesses recovered, and the entire household praised the boundless magic of the priests.
Only one young servant knew the truth, that the entire final panic was triggered by a wild pheasant bursting from a bush. But he kept his mouth shut because no one wanted to believe him.
The truth was too boring, and the spectacle had saved them.
The community collectively chose the comfort of the spectacle over the cold reality of their situation. But while the Jia family is entirely consumed with fighting imaginary monsters using imaginary magic, a very real, completely non-magical disaster is rapidly unfolding in the capital.
The real world is about to breach their walls and shatter the illusion.
This brings us to the final crushing segment. The real monsters arrive.
The exorcism has concluded successfully. Jia Shi is feeling triumphant and is already making plans to move servants back into the garden. Suddenly, Ji Lian rushes into the estate. He brings urgent, devastating news directly from the Ministry of Personnel in the capital.
Jia Zhang, the strict, morally upright patriarch of the family who is currently serving as a government official in the outer provinces, has been officially impeached.
To understand the gravity of this, we must look at the reality of the king bureaucratic system, which the novel heavily mirrors. An impeachment of a high-ranking official is not a mere reprimand.
No, it is a potential death sentence for a family's political standing, their generational wealth, and sometimes their literal lives.
The charge levied against Jia Zhang is incredibly serious. He was impeached by a regional commander, a jidushi, for failing to oversee his subordinates who were overtaxing grain and abusing the citizens.
And Jia Shi's immediate reaction to this catastrophic news is pure, unfiltered denial. He rejects the data entirely.
He tells Jia Lian, "That must be a fake rumor. We just received a letter from Jia Zhang confirming that Tan Shun arrived safely at her wedding destination." And he mentioned that this very same jidushi threw a massive, luxurious banquet to celebrate with them. Why would a man who just bought us dinner turn around and impeach us?
This exchange perfectly encapsulates the profound political naivete of Jia Shi. It highlights the fatal difference between the fake ghosts they chased in the garden and the real apex predators operating in the world.
The family squandered their fortune and their focus fighting imaginary demons, completely ignoring the real parasites, the corrupt servants, and the ruthless political rivals who were actively destroying their reputation and their power in the real world.
The political theater described here is breathtaking. The Jidushi is smiling, toasting Jia Zhang at a lavish banquet, celebrating his daughter's arrival, while simultaneously filing the official paperwork with the emperor to utterly destroy Jia Zhang's career.
It is a masterclass in bureaucratic ruthlessness, and it completely short-circuits Jia. She's understanding of how the world operates. Jia Shi believes politics functions like family dynamics. If we share a meal, we are allies.
The bureaucratic machine is entirely indifferent to your dinner parties. Jia Lian confirms that the news is absolute, undeniable truth. He saw the files. The emperor has already reviewed the case.
And here, we witness the terrifying concept of imperial leniency in action.
The emperor reviews the evidence and notes that Jia Zhang is fundamentally a good man who was simply inexperienced in the brutal realities of local governance and that he was actively deceived by his own staff.
Therefore, instead of executing him or confiscating the family's entire fortune, the emperor exercises leniency. He demotes Jia Zhang 3 full grades and orders him to return to the capital in disgrace immediately.
Demoted 3 grades. In that system, that represents a massive, unrecoverable loss of prestige, income, and structural power.
While Ji Lian is at the ministry gathering this information, he happens to run into a local magistrate from Jiangxi who gives him the real story, the ground truth of what actually occurred in the provinces.
The magistrate explained, look, everyone in the bureaucracy knows your uncle Jia Zhang is a genuinely good man. He reads philosophy, he wants to be righteous, but he is a catastrophically terrible manager.
His servants, the people working directly under his authority, used his pristine name to scam the local populace, steal massive amounts of money, and bully other regional officials. They completely ruined his reputation.
In fact, the Jidushi likely impeached him on this relatively minor charge of failing to oversee, specifically to remove him from power before his corrupt servants triggered a massive peasant rebellion that would result in everyone's execution.
We must explore Jia Zhang's tragic flaw because it serves as a profound lesson for any leader in any era. Personal morality does not equate to administrative competence.
Being a good man who reads philosophy and desires righteous outcomes is completely useless and potentially highly destructive if you lack the operational ruthlessness to prevent the people under your command from abusing the vulnerable.
But I have to push back here. Consider the alternative perspective. Is it genuinely fair to punish Jia Zhang so severely if he honestly did not know what his servants were doing? If they were actively hiding their corruption from him, and even the emperor officially acknowledged that he was deceived? Why is Jia Zhang the one losing 3 grades of rank?
That question strikes at the very core of command responsibility. In the imperial bureaucratic system, and frankly, in modern corporate governance, ignorance is not a defense. Ignorance is the crime itself.
Wow.
If you hold the seal of the office, you are the absolute architect of the culture and the actions of that office. Jia Zhang's failure was not born of malice. It was born of negligence.
And in a high-stakes, highly volatile environment, systemic negligence generates the exact same catastrophic damage as intentional malice.
Exactly. The Jiangxi magistrate is illuminating a dark truth of governance. A weak, good man who is easily manipulated by corrupt subordinates is actually more dangerous to the stability of a region than a highly competent, slightly corrupt man who firmly controls his people.
Perfectly mathematically mirrors exactly what is happening back home in the mansion.
Oh, absolutely.
Lady Wang is presented as a good woman who reads sutras and prays, but her negligence allows the household to fall into ruin, paranoia, and financial collapse.
The entire culture of the Jia family is built on avoiding hard truths. They let the servants run wild. They allow the staff to be paralyzed by imaginary ghosts, while the masters sit in their heated rooms, completely disconnected from the operational reality of their own lives.
The internal decay of the household perfectly mirrors their external political collapse.
As within, so without. The macro is always a reflection of the micro. Because they cannot manage the watchmen in their own garden, they lack the capacity to manage the tax collectors in a province.
The literal ghosts that haunted the Grandview Garden were manifested from the family's internal guilt and complete loss of administrative control.
And the political scandal that brings Jia Zhang down is generated by his exact same failure to control his administrative environment. How does the family handle this world-shattering political news? Jia Lian and Jia Shi decide they must inform Lady Wang. but they immediately agree they must keep the impeachment a total secret from the grandmother, the highest authority in the family.
Out of fear that the shock will kill her.
The cycle of delusion immediately resets. Confronted with reality, they instantly choose to suppress the truth to maintain an illusion of peace.
They begin building another wall of silence, employing the exact same psychological mechanism they used to stage the exorcism to keep the terrifying reality at bay for just a little longer.
It is an incredibly tragic, tightly woven narrative of systemic collapse.
Oh.